returning to the conversation, he said, "You spoke of the Kashalo as a small creature. I have heard of gigantic ones. They are intelligent cetacea. It is said of some that they cover themselves with seaweed and fucus, and then are taken for islands. People encamp upon them, and settle there, lights a fire, and build houses," said Conseil. "Yes, Joker," said Ned Land. "And one fine day the creature plunges, carrying with it all the inhabitants to the bottom of the sea." "Something like the travels of Sinbad the Sailor," I replied, laughing. "Ah!" suddenly exclaimed Ned Land. "It is not one whale, there are 10. There are 20. It is a whole troop. And I not able to do anything, hands and feet tied."
"But, friend Ned," said Conseil, "why do you not ask Captain Nemo's permission to chase them?"
Conseil had not finished his sentence when Ned Land had lowered himself through the panel to seek the captain. A few minutes afterwards, the two appeared together on the platform. Captain Nemo watched the troop of cetacea playing on the waters about a mile from the Nautilus. "They are southern whales," said he. "There goes the fortune of a whole fleet of whalers." "Well, sir," asked the Canadian, "can I not chase them, if only to remind me of my old trade of harpooner?"
"And to what purpose?" replied Captain Nemo.
"Only to destroy. We have nothing to do with the whale oil on board."
"But, sir," continued the Canadian, "in the Red Sea you allowed us to follow the dugong."
"Then it was to procure fresh meat for my crew. Here it would be killing for killing's sake. I know that is a privilege reserved for man, but I do not approve of such murderous pastime. In destroying the southern whale, like the Greenland whale, an inoffensive creature, your traders do a culpable action, Master Land. They have already depopulated the whole of Baffin's Bay, and are annihilating a class of useful animals. Leave the unfortunate cetacea alone. They have plenty of natural enemies, cachalots, swordfish, and sawfish, without you troubling them."
The captain was right. The barbarous and inconsiderate greed of these fishermen will one day cause the disappearance of the last whale in the ocean.
Ned Land whistled Yankee Doodle between his teeth, thrust his hands into his pockets, and turned his back upon us. But Captain Nemo watched the troop of cetacea, and, addressing me, said, "I was right in saying that whales had natural enemies enough, without counting man. These will have plenty to do before long. Do you see, Monsieur Aronnax, about 8 miles to leeward, those blackish moving points?"
"Yes, Captain," I replied.
"Those are cachalots. Terrible animals, which I have met in troops of 200 or 300. As to those, they are cruel, mischievous creatures. They would be right in exterminating them."
The Canadian turned quickly at the last words.
"Well, Captain," said he, "it is still time, in the interest of the whales."
"It is useless to expose oneself, Professor. The Nautilus will disperse them. It is armed with a steel spur as good as Master Land's harpoon, I imagine."
The Canadian did not put himself out enough to shrug his shoulders. Attack cetacea with blows of a spur? Who had ever heard of such a thing?
"Wait, Monsieur Aronnax," said Captain Nemo. "We will show you something you have never yet seen. We have no pity for these ferocious creatures. They are nothing but mouth and teeth.
Mouth and teeth. No one could better describe the macrocephalous cachalot, which is sometimes more than 75 feet long. Its enormous head occupies 1/3 of its entire body. Better armed than the whale, whose upper jaw is furnished only with whalebone, it is supplied with 25 large tusks, about 8 inches long, cylindrical and conical at the top, each weighing 2 pounds. It is in the upper part of this enormous head, in great cavities divided by cartilages, that is to be found from 600 to 800 pounds of that precious oil called spermaceti. The cachalot is a disagreeable creature, more tadpole than fish, according to Fredol's description. It is badly formed, the whole of its left side being, if we may say it, a failure, and being only able to see with its right eye. But the formidable troop was nearing us. They had seen the whales and were preparing to attack them. One could judge beforehand that the Cachalots would be victorious, not only because they were better built for attack than their inoffensive adversaries, but also because they could remain longer underwater without coming to the surface. There was only just time to go to the help of the whales. The Nautilus went underwater. Conseil, Ned Land, and I took our places before the window in the saloon, and Captain Nemo joined the pilot in his cage to work his apparatus as an engine of destruction. Soon I felt the beatings of the screw quicken, and our speed increased. The battle between the Cachalots and the whales had already begun when the Nautilus arrived. They did not at first show any fear at the sight of this new monster joining in the conflict. But they soon had to guard against its blows. What a battle! The Nautilus was nothing but a formidable harpoon brandished by the hand of its captain. It hurled itself against the fleshy mass, passing through from one part to the other, leaving behind it two quivering halves of the animal. It could not feel the formidable blows from their tails upon its sides, nor the shock which it produced itself much more. One Cachalot killed, it ran at the next, tacked on the spot that it might not miss its prey, going forwards and backwards, answering to its helm, plunging when the cetacean dived into the deep waters, coming up with it when it returned to the surface, striking it front or sideways, cutting or tearing in all directions and at any pace, piercing it with its terrible spur. What carnage! What a noise on the surface of the waves! What sharp hissing, and what snorting peculiar to these enraged animals! In the midst of these waters, generally so peaceful, their tails made perfect billows. For 1 hour this wholesale massacre continued, from which the Cachalots could not escape. Several times 10 or 12 united tried to crush the Nautilus by their weight. From the window we could see their enormous mouths, studded with tusks, and their formidable eyes. Ned Land could not contain himself. He threatened and swore at them. We could feel them clinging to our vessel like dogs worrying a wild boar in a copse. But the Nautilus, working its screw, carried them here and there, or to the upper levels of the ocean, without caring for their enormous weight, nor the powerful strain on the vessel. At length the mass of Cachalots broke up, the waves became quiet, and I felt that we were rising to the surface. The panel opened, and we hurried onto the platform. The sea was covered with mutilated bodies. A formidable explosion could not have divided and torn this fleshy mass with more violence. We were floating amid gigantic bodies, bluish on the back and white underneath, covered with enormous protuberances. Some terrified Cachalots were flying towards the horizon. The waves were dyed red for several miles, and the Nautilus floated in a sea of blood. Captain Nemo joined us.
"Well, Master Land?" said he.
"Well, sir," replied the Canadian, whose enthusiasm had somewhat calmed. "It is a terrible spectacle, certainly. But I am not a butcher. I am a hunter, and I call this a butchery."
"It is a massacre of mischievous creatures," replied the captain, "and the Nautilus is not a butcher's knife."
"I like my harpoon better," said the Canadian.
"Everyone to his own," answered the captain, looking fixedly at Ned Land. I feared he would commit some act of violence, which would end in sad consequences. But his anger was turned by the sight of a whale which the Nautilus had just come up with. The creature had not quite escaped from the Cachalot's teeth. I recognized the southern whale by its flat head, which is entirely black. Anatomically, it is distinguished from the white whale and the North Cape whale by the 7 cervical vertebrae, and it has 2 more ribs than its cousins. The unfortunate cetacean was lying on its side, riddled with holes from the bites, and quite dead. From its mutilated fin still hung a young whale which it could not save from the massacre. Its open mouth let the water flow in and out, murmuring like the waves breaking on the shore. Captain Nemo steered close to the corpse of the creature. 2 of his men mounted its side, and I saw, not without surprise, that they were drawing from its breasts all the milk which they contained, that is to say, about 2 or 3 tons.
The captain offered me a cup of the milk, which was still warm. I could not help showing my repugnance to the drink, but he assured me that it was excellent, and not to be distinguished from cow's milk. I tasted it, and was of his opinion. It was a useful reserve to us, for in the shape of salt butter or cheese, it would form an agreeable variety from our ordinary food. From that day I noticed with uneasiness that Ned Land's ill will towards Captain Nemo increased, and I resolved to watch the Canadian's gestures closely.
Chapter 13. The Iceberg. The Nautilus was steadily pursuing its southerly course, following the 50th meridian with considerable speed. Did he wish to reach the pole? I did not think so, for every attempt to reach that point had hitherto failed. Again the season was far advanced, for in the Antarctic regions the 13th of March corresponds with the 13th of September of northern regions, which begin at the equinoctial season. On the 14th of March, I saw floating ice in latitude 55 degrees, merely pale bits of debris from 20 to 25 feet long, forming banks over which the sea curled. The Nautilus remained on the surface of the ocean. Ned Land, who had fished in the Arctic seas, was familiar with its icebergs. But Conseil and I admired them for the first time. In the atmosphere towards the southern horizon stretched a white, dazzling band. English whalers have given it the name of Ice Blink. However thick the clouds may be, it is always visible, and announces the presence of an ice pack or bank. Accordingly, larger blocks soon appeared, whose brilliancy changed with the caprices of the fog. Some of these masses showed green veins, as if long undulating lines had been traced with sulfate of copper. Others resembled enormous amethysts with the light shining through them. Some reflected the light of day upon a thousand crystal facets. Others, shaded with vivid calcareous reflections, resembled a perfect town of marble. The more we neared the south, the more these floating islands increased both in number and importance. At 60 degrees latitude, every pass had disappeared. But, seeking carefully, Captain Nemo soon found a narrow opening, through which he boldly slipped, knowing, however, that it would close behind him. Thus, guided by this clever hand, the Nautilus passed through all the ice with a precision which quite charmed Conseil. Icebergs or mountains, ice fields or smooth plains, seeming to have no limits, drift ice or floating ice packs, plains broken up, called palks when they are circular, and streams when they are made up of long strips. The temperature was very low. The thermometer exposed to the air marked 2 or 3 degrees below zero. But we were warmly clad with fur at the expense of the sea bear and seal. The interior of the Nautilus, warmed regularly by its electric apparatus, defied the most intense cold. Besides, it would only have been necessary to go some yards beneath the waves to find a more bearable temperature. 2 months earlier, we should have had perpetual daylight in these latitudes, but already we had had 3 or 4 hours of night, and by and by there would be 6 months of darkness in these circumpolar regions. On the 15th of March, we were in the latitude of New Shetland and South Orkney. The captain told me that formerly numerous tribes of seals inhabited them, but that English and American whalers, in their rage for destruction, massacred both old and young. Thus, where there was once life and animation, they had left silence and death. About 8 o'clock in the morning of the 16th of March, the Nautilus, following the 55th meridian, cut the Antarctic polar circle. Ice surrounded us on all sides and closed the horizon. But Captain Nemo went from one opening to another, still going higher. I cannot express my astonishment at the beauties of these new regions. The ice took most surprising forms.
Here the grouping formed an oriental town, with innumerable mosques and minarets. There a fallen city thrown to the earth, as it were, by some convulsion of nature. The whole aspect was constantly changed by the oblique rays of the sun, or lost in the grayish fog amidst hurricanes of snow. Detonations and falls were heard on all sides, great overthrows of icebergs, which altered the whole landscape like a diorama. Often seeing no exit, I thought we were definitely prisoners. But instinct guiding him at the slightest indication, Captain Nemo would discover a new pass. He was never mistaken when he saw the thin threads of bluish water trickling along the ice fields. And I had no doubt that he had already ventured into the midst of these Antarctic seas before. On the 16th of March, however, the ice fields absolutely blocked our road. It was not the iceberg itself, as yet, but vast fields cemented by the cold. But this obstacle could not stop Captain Nemo. He hurled himself against it with frightful violence. The Nautilus entered the brittle mass like a wedge, and split it with frightful crackings. It was the battering ram of the ancients hurled by infinite strength. The ice, thrown high in the air, fell like hail around us. By its own power of impulsion, our apparatus made a canal for itself. Sometimes carried away by its own impetus, it lodged on the ice field, crushing it with its weight, and sometimes buried beneath it, dividing it by a simple pitching movement, producing large rents in it. Violent gales assailed us at this time, accompanied by thick fogs, through which, from one end of the platform to the other, we could see nothing. The wind blew sharply from all parts of the compass, and the snow lay in such hard heaps that we had to break it with blows of a pickaxe. The temperature was always at 5 degrees below zero. Every outward part of the Nautilus was covered with ice. A rigged vessel would have been entangled in the blocked-up gorges. A vessel without sails, with electricity for its motive power, and wanting no coal, could alone brave such high latitudes. At length, on the 18th of March, after many useless assaults, the Nautilus was positively blocked. It was no longer either streams, packs, or ice fields, but an interminable and immovable barrier, formed by mountains soldered together. "An iceberg," said the Canadian to me. I knew that to Ned Land, as well as to all other navigators who had preceded us, this was an inevitable obstacle. The sun appearing for an instant at noon, Captain Nemo took an observation as near as possible, which gave our situation at 51 degrees 30 minutes longitude and 67 degrees 39 minutes of south latitude. We had advanced 1 degree more in this Antarctic region. Of the liquid surface of the sea, there was no longer a glimpse. Under the spur of the Nautilus lay stretched a vast plain, entangled with confused blocks. Here and there sharp points and slender needles rising to a height of 200 feet. Further on, a steep shore, hewn as it were with an axe, and clothed with grayish tints. Huge mirrors, reflecting a few rays of sunshine, half drowned in the fog. And over this desolate face of nature, a stern silence reigned, scarcely broken by the flapping of the wings of petrels and puffins. Everything was frozen, even the noise. The Nautilus was then obliged to stop in its adventurous course amid these fields of ice. In spite of our efforts, in spite of the powerful means employed to break up the ice, the Nautilus remained immovable. Generally, when we can proceed no further, we have return still open to us. But here, return was as impossible as advance, for every pass had closed behind us. And for the few moments when we were stationary, we were likely to be entirely blocked, which did indeed happen about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the fresh ice forming around its sides with astonishing rapidity. I was obliged to admit that Captain Nemo was more than imprudent. I was on the platform at that moment. The captain had been observing our situation for some time past, when he said to me, "Well, sir, what do you think of this?"
I think that we are caught, Captain.
So, Monsieur Aronnax, you really think that the Nautilus cannot disengage itself?
With difficulty, Captain.
For the season is already too far advanced for you to reckon on the breaking of the ice.
Ah, sir, said Captain Nemo, in an ironical tone, you will always be the same. You see nothing but difficulties and obstacles. I affirm that not only can the Nautilus disengage itself, but also that it can go further still.
Further to the south? I asked, looking at the captain.
Yes, sir. It shall go to the pole.
To the pole? I exclaimed, unable to repress a gesture of incredulity.
Yes, replied the captain coldly. To the Antarctic pole. To that unknown point from whence springs every meridian of the globe. You know whether I can do as I please with the Nautilus.
Yes, I knew that.
I knew that this man was bold even to rashness. But to conquer those obstacles which bristled round the South Pole, rendering it more inaccessible than the North, which had not yet been reached by the boldest navigators, was it not a mad enterprise, one which only a maniac would have conceived? It then came into my head to ask Captain Nemo if he had ever discovered that pole which had never yet been trodden by a human creature.
No, sir, he replied, but we will discover it together. Where others have failed, I will not fail. I have never yet led my Nautilus so far into southern seas, but, I repeat, it shall go further yet.
I can well believe you, Captain, said I, in a slightly ironical tone.
I believe you. Let us go ahead. There are no obstacles for us. Let us smash this iceberg. Let us blow it up, and if it resists, let us give the Nautilus wings to fly over it.
Over it, sir, said Captain Nemo quietly.
No, not over it, but under it.
Under it? I exclaimed, a sudden idea of the captain's project flashing upon my mind. I understood. The wonderful qualities of the Nautilus were going to serve us in this superhuman enterprise.
I see we are beginning to understand one another, sir, said the captain, half smiling. You begin to see the possibility, I should say the success, of this attempt. That which is impossible for an ordinary vessel is easy to the Nautilus. If a continent lies before the pole, it must stop before the continent. But if, on the contrary, the pole is washed by open sea, it will go even to the pole.
Certainly, said I, carried away by the captain's reasoning. If the surface of the sea is solidified by the ice, the lower depths are free by the providential law which has placed the maximum of density of the waters of the ocean 1 degree higher than freezing point. And if I am not mistaken, the portion of this iceberg which is above the water is as 1 to 4 to that which is below.
Very nearly, sir. For 1 foot of iceberg above the sea, there are 3 below it. If these ice mountains are not more than 300 feet above the surface, they are not more than 900 beneath. And what are 900 feet to the Nautilus?
Nothing, sir.
It could even seek at greater depths that uniform temperature of seawater, and there brave with impunity the 30 or 40 degrees of surface cold.
Just so, sir. Just so, I replied, getting animated.
The only difficulty, continued Captain Nemo, is that of remaining several days without renewing our provision of air.
Is that all? The Nautilus has vast reservoirs. We can fill them, and they will supply us with all the oxygen we want.
Well thought of, Monsieur Aronnax, replied the captain, smiling. But, not wishing you to accuse me of rashness, I will first give you all my objections.
Have you any more to make?
Only one. It is possible, if the sea exists at the South Pole, that it may be covered. And, consequently, we shall be unable to come to the surface.
Good, sir.
But do you forget that the Nautilus is armed with a powerful spur? And could we not send it diagonally against these fields of ice, which would open at the shocks? Ah, sir, you are full of ideas today.
Besides, Captain, I added enthusiastically, why should we not find the sea open at the South Pole as well as at the North? The frozen poles of the earth do not coincide, either in the southern or in the northern regions. And until it is proved to the contrary, we may suppose either a continent or an ocean free from ice at these two points of the globe.
I think so too, Monsieur Aronnax, replied Captain Nemo. I only wish you to observe that, after having made so many objections to my project, you are now crushing me with arguments in its favor.
The preparations for this audacious attempt now began. The powerful pumps of the Nautilus were working air into the reservoirs and storing it at high pressure. About 4 o'clock, Captain Nemo announced the closing of the panels on the platform. I threw one last look at the massive iceberg which we were going to cross. The weather was clear, the atmosphere pure enough, the cold very great, being 12 degrees below zero. But the wind having gone down, this temperature was not so unbearable. About 10 men mounted the sides of the Nautilus, armed with pickaxes to break the ice around the vessel, which was soon free. The operation was quickly performed, for the fresh ice was still very thin. We all went below. The usual reservoirs were filled with the newly liberated water, and the Nautilus soon descended. I had taken my place with Conseil in the saloon. Through the open window we could see the lower beds of the Southern Ocean. The thermometer went up. The needle of the compass deviated on the dial. At about 900 feet, as Captain Nemo had foreseen, we were floating beneath the undulating bottom of the iceberg. But the Nautilus went lower still. It went to the depth of 400 fathoms. The temperature of the water at the surface showed 12 degrees. It was now only 10. We had gained 2. I need not say the temperature of the Nautilus was raised by its heating apparatus to a much higher degree. Every maneuver was accomplished with wonderful precision.
"We shall pass it, if you please, sir," said Conseil.
"I believe we shall," I said, in a tone of firm conviction.
In this open sea the Nautilus had taken its course direct to the pole, without leaving the 52nd meridian. From 67 degrees 30 minutes to 90 degrees, 22 degrees and a half of latitude remained to travel. That is, about 500 leagues. The Nautilus kept up a mean speed of 26 miles an hour, the speed of an express train. If that was kept up in 40 hours, we should reach the pole. For a part of the night, the novelty of the situation kept us at the window. The sea was lit with the electric lantern, but it was deserted. Fishes did not sojourn in these imprisoned waters. They only found there a passage to take them from the Antarctic Ocean to the open polar sea. Our pace was rapid. We could feel it by the quivering of the long steel body. About 2 in the morning I took some hours' repose, and Conseil did the same. In crossing the waste, I did not meet Captain Nemo. I supposed him to be in the pilot's cage. The next morning, the 19th of March, I took my post once more in the saloon. The electric log told me that the speed of the Nautilus had been slackened. It was then going towards the surface, but prudently emptying its reservoirs very slowly. My heart beat fast. Were we going to emerge and regain the open polar atmosphere? No. A shock told me that the Nautilus had struck the bottom of the iceberg, still very thick, judging from the deadened sound. We had indeed struck, to use a sea expression, but in an inverse sense, and at 1,000 feet deep. This would give 3,000 feet of ice above us, 1,000 being above the watermark. The iceberg was then higher than at its borders. Not a very reassuring fact. Several times that day the Nautilus tried again, and every time it struck the wall which lay like a ceiling above it. Sometimes it met with but 900 yards, only 200 of which rose above the surface. It was twice the height it was when the Nautilus had gone under the waves. I carefully noted the different depths, and thus obtained a submarine profile of the chain as it was developed under the water. That night, no change had taken place in our situation. Still ice between 400 and 500 yards in depth. It was evidently diminishing, but still what a thickness between us and the surface of the ocean. It was then 8. According to the daily custom on board the Nautilus, its air should have been renewed 4 hours ago. But I did not suffer much, although Captain Nemo had not yet made any demand upon his reserve of oxygen. My sleep was painful that night. Hope and fear besieged me by turns. I rose several times. The groping of the Nautilus continued. About 3 in the morning I noticed that the lower surface of the iceberg was only about 50 feet deep. 150 feet now separated us from the surface of the waters. The iceberg was by degrees becoming an ice field, the mountain a plain. My eyes never left the manometer. We were still rising diagonally to the surface, which sparkled under the electric rays. The iceberg was stretching both above and beneath into lengthening slopes. Mile after mile it was getting thinner. At length, at 6 in the morning of that memorable day, the 19th of March, the door of the saloon opened, and Captain Nemo appeared. "The sea is open," was all he said. Chapter 14. The South Pole. I rushed onto the platform. Yes, the open sea with but a few scattered pieces of ice and moving icebergs. A long stretch of sea. A world of birds in the air, and myriads of fishes under those waters, which varied from intense blue to olive green, according to the bottom. The thermometer marked 3 degrees centigrade above zero. It was comparatively spring, shut up as we were behind this iceberg, whose lengthened mass was dimly seen on our northern horizon. "Are we at the pole?" I asked the captain, with a beating heart. "I do not know," he replied. "At noon I will take our bearings." "But will the sun show himself through this fog?" said I, looking at the leaden sky. "However little it shows, it will be enough," replied the captain. About 10 miles south, a solitary island rose to a height of 104 yards. We made for it, but carefully, for the sea might be strewn with banks. 1 hour afterwards we had reached it. 2 hours later we had made the round of it. It measured 4 or 5 miles in circumference. A narrow canal separated it from a considerable stretch of land, perhaps a continent, for we could not see its limits. The existence of this land seemed to give some color to Maury's theory. The ingenious American has remarked that, between the South Pole and the 60th parallel, the sea is covered with floating ice of enormous size, which is never met with in the North Atlantic. From this fact, he has drawn the conclusion that the Antarctic Circle encloses considerable continents, as icebergs cannot form in open sea, but only on the coasts. According to these calculations, the mass of ice surrounding the southern pole forms a vast cap, the circumference of which must be at least 2,500 miles. But the Nautilus, for fear of running aground, had stopped about 3 cable lengths from a strand over which reared a superb heap of rocks. The boat was launched. The captain, 2 of his men bearing instruments, Conseil and myself, were in it. It was 10 in the morning. I had not seen Ned Land. Doubtless the Canadian did not wish to admit the presence of the South Pole. A few strokes of the oar brought us to the sand, where we ran ashore. Conseil was going to jump on to the land when I held him back. "Sir," said I to Captain Nemo, "to you belongs the honor of first setting foot on this land." "Yes, sir," said the captain. "And if I do not hesitate to tread this South Pole, it is because, up to this time, no human being has left a trace there." Saying this, he jumped lightly onto the sand. His heart beat with emotion. He climbed a rock, sloping to a little promontory, and there, with his arms crossed, mute and motionless, and with an eager look, he seemed to take possession of these southern regions. After 5 minutes passed in this ecstasy, he turned to us.
When you like, sir.
I landed, followed by Conseil, leaving the two men in the boat. For a long way the soil was composed of a reddish, sandy stone, something like crushed brick, scoriae, streams of lava, and pumice stones. One could not mistake its volcanic origin. In some parts, slight curls of smoke emitted a sulphurous smell, proving that the internal fires had lost nothing of their expansive powers. Though having climbed a high acclivity, I could see no volcano for a radius of several miles. We know that in those Antarctic countries, James Ross found two craters, the Erebus and Terror, in full activity, on the 167th meridian, latitude 77 degrees 32 minutes. The vegetation of this desolate continent seemed to me much restricted. Some lichens lay upon the black rocks, some microscopic plants, rudimentary diatomas, a kind of cells placed between two quartz shells. Long purple and scarlet weed, supported on little swimming bladders, which the breaking of the waves brought to the shore. These constituted the meager flora of this region. The shore was strewn with mollusks, little mussels, and limpets. I also saw myriads of northern clios, 1¼ inches long, of which a whale would swallow a whole world at a mouthful, and some perfect sea butterflies, animating the waters on the skirts of the shore. There appeared on the high bottoms some coral shrubs, of the kind which, according to James Ross, live in the Antarctic seas to the depth of more than 1,000 yards. Then there were little kingfishers and starfish studding the soil. But where life abounded most was in the air. There, thousands of birds fluttered and flew of all kinds, deafening us with their cries. Others crowded the rock, looking at us as we passed by without fear, and pressing familiarly close by our feet. There were penguins, so agile in the water, heavy and awkward as they are on the ground. They were uttering harsh cries, a large assembly, sober in gesture but extravagant in clamor. Albatrosses passed in the air, the expanse of their wings being at least 4½ yards, and justly called the vultures of the ocean. Some gigantic petrels, and some damiers, a kind of small duck, the underpart of whose body is black and white. Then there were a whole series of petrels, some whitish, with brown-bordered wings, others blue, peculiar to the Antarctic seas, and so oily, as I told Conseil, that the inhabitants of the Faroe Islands had nothing to do before lighting them but to put a wick in.
"A little more," said Conseil, "and they would be perfect lamps. After that we cannot expect nature to have previously furnished them with wicks."
About 1/2 mile farther on the soil was riddled with ruffs' nests, a sort of laying ground, out of which many birds were issuing. Captain Nemo had some hundreds hunted. They uttered a cry like the braying of an ass, were about the size of a goose, slate color on the body, white beneath, with a yellow line round their throats. They allowed themselves to be killed with a stone, never trying to escape. But the fog did not lift, and at 11 the sun had not yet shown itself. Its absence made me uneasy. Without it, no observations were possible. How then could we decide whether we had reached the pole? When I rejoined Captain Nemo, I found him leaning on a piece of rock, silently watching the sky. He seemed impatient and vexed. But what was to be done? This rash and powerful man could not command the sun as he did the sea. Noon arrived without the orb of day showing itself for an instant. We could not even tell its position behind the curtain of fog. And soon the fog turned to snow.
"Till tomorrow," said the captain quietly.
And we returned to the Nautilus amid these atmospheric disturbances. The tempest of snow continued till the next day. It was impossible to remain on the platform. From the saloon, where I was taking notes of incidents happening during this excursion to the polar continent, I could hear the cries of petrels and albatrosses sporting in the midst of this violent storm. The Nautilus did not remain motionless, but skirted the coast, advancing 10 miles more to the south, in the half-light left by the sun as it skirted the edge of the horizon. The next day, the 20th of March, the snow had ceased. The cold was a little greater, the thermometer showing 2 degrees below zero. The fog was rising, and I hoped that that day our observations might be taken. Captain Nemo not having yet appeared, the boat took Conseil and myself to land. The soil was still of the same volcanic nature. Everywhere were traces of lava, scoriae, and basalt. But the crater which had vomited them, I could not see. Here, as lower down, this continent was alive with myriads of birds. But their rule was now divided with large troops of sea mammals, looking at us with their soft eyes. There were several kinds of seals, some stretched on the earth, some on flakes of ice, many going in and out of the sea. They did not flee at our approach, never having had anything to do with man, and I reckoned that there were provisions there for hundreds of vessels.
"Sir," said Conseil, "will you tell me the names of these creatures?"
"They are seals and morses." It was now 8 in the morning. 4 hours remained to us before the sun could be observed with advantage. I directed our steps towards a vast bay cut in the steep granite shore. There, I can aver that earth and ice were lost to sight by the numbers of sea mammals covering them, and I involuntarily sought for old Proteus, the mythological shepherd who watched these immense flocks of Neptune. There were more seals than anything else, forming distinct groups, male and female, the father watching over his family, the mother suckling her little ones, some already strong enough to go a few steps. When they wished to change their place, they took little jumps, made by the contraction of their bodies, and helped awkwardly enough by their imperfect fin, which, as with the manatee, their cousins, forms a perfect forearm. I should say that in the water, which is their element, the spine of these creatures is flexible, with smooth and close skin and webbed feet. They swim admirably. In resting on the earth, they take the most graceful attitudes. Thus the ancients, observing their soft and expressive looks, which cannot be surpassed by the most beautiful look a woman can give, their clear, voluptuous eyes, their charming positions, and the poetry of their manners, metamorphosed them, the male into a triton, and the female into a mermaid. I made Conseil notice the considerable development of the lobes of the brain in these interesting cetaceans. No mammal, except man, has such a quantity of brain matter. They are also capable of receiving a certain amount of education, are easily domesticated, and I think, with other naturalists, that if properly taught, they would be of great service as fishing dogs. The greater part of them slept on the rocks or on the sand. Amongst these seals, properly so called, which have no external ears, in which they differ from the otter, whose ears are prominent, I noticed several varieties of seals about 3 yards long, with a white coat, bulldog heads, armed with teeth in both jaws, 4 incisors at the top and 4 at the bottom, and 2 large canine teeth in the shape of a fleur-de-lis. Amongst them glided sea elephants, a kind of seal with short, flexible trunks. The giants of this species measured 20 feet round and 10 yards and a half in length. But they did not move as we approached.
"These creatures are not dangerous?" asked Conseil.
"No, not unless you attack them. When they have to defend their young, their rage is terrible, and it is not uncommon for them to break the fishing boats to pieces."
"They are quite right," said Conseil.
"I do not say they are not."
2 miles farther on, we were stopped by the promontory which shelters the bay from the southerly winds. Beyond it, we heard loud bellowings, such as a troop of ruminants would produce.
"Good," said Conseil, "a concert of bulls."
"No, a concert of morses."
"They are fighting."
"They are either fighting or playing."
We now began to climb the blackish rocks, amid unforeseen stumbles, and over stones which the ice made slippery. More than once I rolled over at the expense of my loins. Conseil, more prudent or more steady, did not stumble, and helped me up, saying, "If, sir, you would have